of the general status of their research and to what extent it was being continued. It had presumably been very much slowed down, but not wholly stopped. Later arrivals at Alsace included men from Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio, and Langley Field in Virginia. And finally, perhaps currently, finally, a former pupil of Prandtl's, now in America, and probably Prandtl's successor as the number one man in the world. Eichen was an old acquaintance. Eichen was one of the leading physical chemists of Germany, and I spent a day going over the work of his Institute of Physical Chemistry, which according to my recollection was not very actively engaged in military research. We talked on a friendly basis, and Eichen presented me with two volumes of his Fundamentals of Physical Chemistry. The edition which he gave me had been published in Leipzig in 1944, the fifth year of the war. It was interesting as a well-produced and bound book, far superior in appearance to the books that Germany produced during the years after the First World War. On April 13th, when I entered the great room at the Aerodynamics Institute, which was used as an officer's mess, I became conscious of a hushed atmosphere. And then I learned that word had just come through of the death of President Roosevelt. Although he had seemed far away, he had been the great leader of the war effort, and although his appearance had indicated in pictures, had given every indication of extremely bad health, his sudden death came as a shock to everyone. Paragraph. Professor Walter Colby of the University of Michigan whom I have mentioned before, was secretary of the civilian division of Alsace. He was with us in Göttingen. He was a man of wisdom who had done much to build up the physics department at Michigan, and a man of culture and quiet charm who made a very effective intelligence operator and a very pleasant companion. Word came to us that a committee from the faculty of the University of Göttingen would like to wait upon us. Presently, three prominent professors, one of them Eucken, one I believe a professor of English, and the third I cannot recall. These three men came to see us, and after telling of the chaotic condition of things at the university, asked us if we would take over the supervision of the university. What it amounted to was an invitation to accept the presidency or rectorship of one of the greatest German universities. The thought seemed rather preposterous, and of course was out of the question. I suspect that when we eyed each other, we had to force a certain solemnity, because the whole idea struck us both as so preposterous as to be amusing. We discussed some of the difficulties, but said regretfully that our important duties would prevent our acceptance of any authority. For letters and documents previously found by Alsace, it had become evident that something of importance was going on in the vicinity of the town of Northeim, Northeim, about 21 kilometers north of Göttingen. This, indeed, had been a prime objective in coming to Göttingen. On April 12th, Colby and I, with two jeeps and a military escort of perhaps four men, including our drivers, drove to the vicinity of Northheim and discovered our objective in the country, in the nearby country, at a place called Lindau, L-I-N-D-A-U. Actually, in a small medieval fortress. Built of old red stone and surrounded by a moat. A place called the Wasserburg, capital W-A-S-S-E-R-B-U-R-G, we found the director and the files of the Reichsforschungsrat, the German National Research Council. The director, Osenberg, O-S-E-N-B-E-R-G, was there with a middle-aged woman secretary and great quantities of files covering a vast amount of German research. It was of such importance that we spent some day, that we requested that a small military unit be stationed at the Wasserburg to guard it from possible attack by hostile Germans. The myth of werewolves, W-E-R-E-W-O-L-V-E-S, still persisted. It was thought that stray bands of SS men or merely hostile Germans might be hiding in the countryside, ready to attack small Allied units or do whatever damage a small military unit of perhaps 15 men, commanded by a captain, arrived soon to guard the files and Dr. Osenberg until they could be removed to a safer place. April 17th, we left Göttingen for the town of Celle, about 150 kilometers to the north. This was an ancient city of 25,000 inhabitants with many old stucco-covered houses and a castle standing in a park. This was a British territory, which meant a considerable change to us. We, on arrival, we looked for a place to stay, and were received hospitably by some British officers quartered in a large building. They showed us a large room with quite a bit of empty space in one corner, and said that we were more than welcome to lay our sleeping bags on that part of the floor. As the floor looked rather hard, we hoped other arrangements might be possible. This proved to be the case, and we found quarters in a large, comfortable house occupied by the elderly owner of the house, a woman. Here the four of us, I believe I was the only scientist, the other three being military men, set up our sleeping bags in the former dining room of the house, a large room which seemed to be the safest thing to do. We did not care to get separated in what was potentially hostile territory. One item featured the room, apparently a large portrait of Adolf Hitler, a very common sight in many, if not most, German houses. I did not examine the portrait, which was, on the whole, rather imposing, no worse than most of the Hitler portraits, until the lady of the house complained to us that the previous occupants of the room, British soldiers, had profaned the portrait of her grandfather by putting a Hitler mustache on it. So the portrait, which we had lightly taken to be a characteristic Hitler showing, proved to be that of her grandfather. Regrettably, there was nothing we could do to remove the mustache, which I'm afraid struck us as a little funny. On the opposite side of the street, a few doors from our house of residence, a yellow flag hanging from a house indicated that it was being used as a typhus hospital. This made us feel a little cautious. We succeeded in getting ourselves invited to a British mess, which proved interesting. The British officers told us that the night before, the evening before, while it was still daylight, German bombers had come overhead. The British Spitfires had taken off after them, and apparently succeeded in catching up as they returned shortly after, dipping their wings in sign of triumph. the notorious Nazi concentration camp of Belsen, B-E-L-S-E-N, was near Celle. One of the British officers told me that a Scottish regiment had been the first to enter Belsen and had found conditions so horrible that they did not bother to arrest the camp guards for future trial, but they themselves meted out immediate justice. Some of the British officers I talked to had been to the camp themselves and said that conditions were unbelievable. One inmate, a middle-aged woman, had gone completely out of her mind and was roaming about costumed only in a large hat. This was in pretty chilly weather in northern Germany. I thought of making a visit to the camp as part of my investigative job, but decided that it was, but learned that some young British medics had been sent over hastily immediately after the opening of the camp, and although they had been inoculated for typhus before leaving Britain, some caught typhus and died. The time elapsed between the inoculation and the attainment of immunity being not having been attained. The main Alsace objective in the Celle area was a factory engaged in the manufacture of parachute silk. A physicist named Grote had constructed a small laboratory in this factory where he had built a centrifuge for isotope separation. This was of considerable importance and was further inspected by Alsace. The military members of the Alsace mission who visited the factory liberated considerable quantities of the parachute silk, enough to make scarves for almost the whole Alsace mission, both in Germany and Paris. I still have a scarf made of camouflaged parachute silk. from Silla, we drove to Hanover to visit a big chemical factory in the vicinity. Hanover had been severely bombed, and as we drove through the streets, in one place we saw where a bomb had landed beside a streetcar track and blown the track and blown a section of the track so that it pointed vertically. And those perpendicular, a 30-foot length, rising perpendicularly from street level. In another place, a large bomb had missed a railroad bridge and made a huge crater in the street which passed under the bridge. As it rained a good deal of the time, the crater was full of water. My driver, practicing the Alsace principle of driving fast in a straight line, continued into the lake, filling the crater. It was all right until we got to about the middle of the lake, when our engine was flooded and we came to an ignominious halt in some 2 or 3 feet of water. We were not happy at the idea of having to wade through the lake, and we needed help in extracting the car. So my driver merely ordered some passing citizens to push the car out of the lake, which they did with complete obedience and good humor. It was a striking example of the German attitude of subservience to authority. Our uniforms represented authority, though at the moment not much wisdom. When the car had been pulled out of the lake, the motor was soon dried out and we proceeded on our way. The chemical factory proved to be a large one, where we found little of immediate interest. However, we were very heartily welcomed by two managers who stood at the entrance, bowing low like robots. As we entered the building, a man appeared suddenly at the far end of a long hall and disappeared even more suddenly. Apparently, he was one of many slave laborers who had been liberated in part when our army arrived. They presented a serious problem, not only here, but all over liberated